your heart beats faster and faster.
Hey guys, it's Easter once again, but more importantly, it's Sunday night, 9:30, and this is your Ghost Benedict Demon Hunter Show.
That's right, Paranormal Broadcasting, where we don't think the universe is out to get us, we're just paranoid. Wait, did I say that backwards?
No, we're paranoid, all right.
Hey, speak gang, the truth. He speaks the truth.
He does. Very educated. Hey gang, we are back live in studio. We'll be in the G&D chat room. John?
I am here too. Magnus is back in the office again. Yay.
And we'll be in the chat room all night long.
And you can log into that chat room by going to our website at www.ghostanddemon.com.
And of course, this is your ghost man, Sean B.
And that would make me Nathan S., a.k.a. the Demon Hunter.
And that would make this the special Easter Sunday edition of our little show.
The Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show is independently produced by Nathan Schoonover and Sean Burris's broadcast live every Sunday on Absurd Radio, Planet Paranormal Radio, and is recorded for Planet Paranormal Radio, the Black Vault Radio Network, and the Para X Radio Network.
We got a big, fat, juicy Easter egg for all you Easter fans out there today. We got a good one, guys. Tonight's guest, previously heard on... Hold on 1 second. Okay, here we go.
Preparedness. Guest... That's what makes this the best show in the world, how prepared we are.
I know. Tonight's guest, previously heard on Coast to Coast AM and many other radio and TV shows across the nation, author of Star Child Skull Essentials, researcher and keeper of the skull, Lloyd Pye from StarChildProject.com will be in studio to discuss the facts behind the Star Child and much, much more. The hunt for the truth the government doesn't want you to know about tonight on your G&D show.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that. Ooh.
Goosebumps.
Goosebumps, because the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show is beyond the normal broadcast, and it starts right now.
Are you heathens and hooligans? You won't get the hell out of here. Follow someone else for a while now, brother. I can use a beer. Don't need you and I don't need this. I want to make this perfectly clear. Listen up, heathens and hooligans. You want to get the hell out of here. Yeah, you heathens and hooligans.
And now, the original Bad Boys of Paranormal, and your host for tonight's show, Ghostman and Demon Hunter.
Yes.
Thank you, Demon Bob.
Demon
Bob. Good to hear his voice.
Is that Demon Bob? I always wonder what his name was.
That's Demon Bob, yep. And Demon Bob has been with us for a while now, since the beginning.
Yes! Since the very first show.
He's got the easiest job on the whole show.
Since the very first show, which we do not suggest you go back and listen to in the archive, because it's terrible.
You know, I actually considered not putting it on the archives when we moved our archives over, but then I said, what the heck, and I did it, and, well.
You gotta start somewhere. That's how it always goes.
That was our very first show with our buddy Doug Semick of Ghostly Talk.
All right. We didn't even know we were on halfway through it. You know, I'm starting to think, I tell you though, Demon Hunter, I like hearing Magnus's voice here in studio, man. I think we might have to sweet talk him into a full-time gig on the show. What do you think about it? I think it's good.
It's a good idea. I think it's a good idea. I mean, he's got no life like us, so it's...
Oh, I tell you about my life. Of course, everybody knows I got the kids, the brats, and I took them everywhere today. It's hard when you got all – I mean, family's great. I love Easter. I hope everybody out there had a beautiful Easter. I know it was gorgeous here in central Indiana, and not a cloud in the sky, man. It was beautiful. The Easter egg hunts, all that stuff. But I felt like I was pulled in 50,000 different directions today. And, I mean, I just got home at like 7:30 and sat down and started going over my notes for the night show. And I was like, my God. You know, I was trying to read some of the literature I got on Lloyd Pye and on the Star Child expeditions and all that stuff while the kids were Easter egg hunting today. And Whoa, my head was spinning, man. But they got some cool stuff. They're at that funny little age now. Eight, Devin's 8, Drake's 4, where they pick up the eggs, and instead of just liking the color, they shake it. They shake it to hear the jingle, man, or better yet, just to hear, you know, hear nothing. Then you know you got solid cash, so.
Paper cash, that's the way to go. Good job.
How'd you guys go? Did you guys have a good Easter?
I had a blast myself. I went down to my my family has a big I grew up on a farm. I'm a farm kid. And my family is a big family down in the country. So I grabbed I have a Boston Terrier, Phineas. I grabbed him, ran down and hanged with the family, played fetch outside with the dog, and just had a nice, quiet, fun family, you know, event.
That sounds good. Lots of food.
You guys have seen a photo of me. There's nothing about me that's nothing small with food. You know, it's like, keep eating, sure. So actually, a quick side note before I was going to joke around. If anyone in Rochester, I'm from Rochester, New York. If you're ever driving through, you could see my name in lights. I did a food challenge the other day, and I ate this ginormous burger, which I thought everyone could do. But if you're in Rochester, you get to check out. You see my name in lights for finishing a giant hamburger. So gluttony, wow. I tell you. Yeah,
you're going to die like John Wayne with like 10 pounds of red undigested meat in your –
That's a goal to have. That's a goal I'm going to have. That's great.
That's an American man. That's how to go out.
Well, I it's funny. A friend of mine dragged me along to it. So I know this is not really paranormal per se, but it definitely could go along with the overeating today. But I was dragged along, and it was a big, huge – called the Atomic Challenge. And they're like, oh, do you guys want to do it? I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? And they brought the food out. I was one of 5 guys, and I was the only guy to finish it. And I was like, oh, it's not that bad. I could do it, maybe. And I ended up did, and it's still up there. My name's still on lights. It's kind of scary.
Awesome. Oh, congratulations. You know, this Easter time, though, it's a wild time of year because, you know, it's kind of like Christmas because you have the whole Bible thing, and you have, you know, some people do that, and then you have the, you know, the resurrection of Christ, which would be the Bible thing, and then you have the Easter Bunny and the eggs. And I was thinking about that today. I was pondering as I was driving down the road, and I started thinking, how in the heck do you go from the resurrection of Christ to an Easter Bunny with eggs?
Do you really want to know, Sean? Do you really want to know? Because this is part of that useless information that Nathan knows, and I have the answer.
Well, they put the cross inside of a bunny hole. That's actually what the true fact is, right? Is that it?
Oh. Well, let's see what Sean has here.
Oh.
I remember you talked about it, though, Nathan. We discussed this before. I forget what you said. Won't you hit it up again? Tell us the history. Well, it's like Wiccan, isn't it?
It's Wiccan, but Wiccan is more of the modern version of the traditional pagan practice. And it goes back to Astara. And Astara was a goddess, and her cart was pulled, but her chariot was pulled, or cart, whatever you want to call it. Was pulled by rabbits, and her symbol was the egg. So when the Christian church was trying to convince pagans that they should follow Christian traditions, they kind of mixed the pagan traditions into them so that the people would be more willing to celebrate them. So the tradition of the rabbit and the egg got mixed into the Easter celebration, because it was a spring celebration, and that would be when the pagans celebrated Astara.
Very cool.
And the chocolate comes from where?
Sweden.
Sweden. Sir Gareth just said in the chat room he thinks it's somewhere over in France where a flying bell, B-E-L-L, delivers candy on Easter.
A flying bell.
Yeah, a bell.
Okay.
You know?
Oh no, you have
Maybe
the bell.
Maybe this one.
You have the bell. Oh no. But no, it's you know, you get back to that. And my question, like, you, everybody's got their questions they throw out there. Magnus's was, where does the chalk come from? I wanted to know where the little baskets came from. Like, was there a cart, a little wicker basket, a little wicker basket that that's right, folks.
Wicked
have
basket
a drink.
Works perfect right there, by the way. Wicked basket. From this point on, it's now that.
Have a drink, folks. It's okay.
It helps us.
A little wicker basket, but no, it's you know, just kind of the tradition. But I'm always fascinated with how and why people believe things, and I've gotten to go to a few Astara festivals, and
that's cool. Well, I think what gets me is go ahead, John.
No, actually, mine is just another question. I was kind of, how many rabbits does it take to pull a cart? Do you know that answer?
It was two rabbits, and they were big rabbits.
I'm hoping, because, I mean, me, it take a large...
Look at the bones! Okay. Look at the bones and the teeth! And the
sharp pointy teeth!
Yeah, but
it was a very powerful rabbit.
What gets me about the holidays is, you know, it's for the kids, and they run around and stuff, but all our holidays, pretty much... are wrapped around, not just Halloween, it's all wrapped around a spiritual essence. The holidays. I mean, somebody's died, somebody's resurrected. It has a tight connection with the other side. You guys get what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it does.
And
I think
that's really cool. I mean, you got Christmas.
Yep.
You know, which is a very spiritual holiday. Easter, very spiritual for a lot of people, holiday. And I think it's neat.
I don't think it's fair, though, because of the circles I move in and trying to learn what I learn. A lot of people, you know, come to me because I'm an occultist, and they'll say, you know, oh, well, you know, the Christian church stole this from the pagans. And right. I don't think that's really a fair thing to say, because the Christians had their own reasons to celebrate, and they integrated, and everything gets integrated these days. And
they's integrated!
Yes, yes. They's integrating them. But
they's integrated.
But,
So I do have a question now, too, for, you know, if talking about last week in the chat room, we're talking about the EVPs last week on the show.
I was just mentioning that to the guys earlier. I should have cut those to play them during the show. One of them I did prove with an EVP I thought I heard was somebody exhaling. And that's why you go back and you listen to things, because it wasn't an EVP.
Uh-huh.
But there is a sound during the thing that I can't figure out what it is, and I'm actually going to cut it and send it to last week's guest.
Well, he
Ryan.
Was actually, I found out about the investigation, Ryan Burns, he was in someone's backyard in a tent doing this investigation. It was an outdoors investigation.
Okay.
And I don't know much about it, but it was something about hidden ruins, hidden caverns where there was activity happening around him. I don't know if it was ghostly activity or alien activity, but it was something like that. So,
you know, I'm having trouble here, Mike. I have a Camacho cigar, which I got from Butthead's Tobacco Emporium in Danbury, Connecticut.
Butthead's!
And it keeps going out on me. And
it's called a Camacho?
Camacho.
Camacho. Sexy time.
That's right.
Sexy time. Oh, oh, man. Okay, and, hey, we got our first story of the week from the G&D Show Archives.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. Keep your eye on your arm. It's about to turn into a smartphone. You guys ready for this?
Okay.
Scientists have taken the next step in smartphone technology, and it's sure to have gadget-hungry baby boomers drooling. They're getting rid of the phone and replacing it with a touchscreen input pad on your arm. Researchers at Microsoft and Carnegie Mellon University are creating an armband that projects an interface directly on your skin, turning your arm into a touchscreen surface by picking up ultra-low sounds produced when you tap different areas. Different skin locations are acoustically distinct because of bone density and the filtering effect from soft tissue and joints. Software matches sound frequencies to specific skin locations. The band uses a mini projector to create a changing display and a sophisticated sensor that can tell which part of your arm is being tapped. The skin put can be used to make phone calls, navigate the web, control audio devices, and play games. This is cutting-edge tech. The cutting-edge technology, says lead researcher Chris Harrison. You'll begin to see such interfaces emerge within the next 5 years, guys.
Now, here's here's my question, Sean. If you're wearing the armband on your right hand, your right arm, and you type in 666, who do you call?
See, you call Satan! You know, that's what you say that, but that's getting dangerously close. See, when I was raised, it was Southern Baptist. Okay? And my dad did the Southern Baptist thing. He took us to church and everything. And I remember they would take us downstairs at this church we went to, and it was Bible school, and they would show us videos of the end of the world. This guy would wake up, you know, and he wasn't saved, and he's like, hello, hello. It's like that classic Twilight Zone. The guy wakes up, and he wished he was the only guy there, you know, and everybody else has gone off the planet, and he breaks his glasses. You guys remember that one?
He went down into the vault to read the newspaper, and...
Right. Yeah. Broke his glasses. But that's kind of so how this fun. Was. But they're showing this to 12 and 13-year-old kids. I was scared to death. You know?
That's what you do. I mean, when you're going to... I'm trying to sound bad, not sound bad here, but you show kids stuff back then, impressionable time. You do it for brainwashing, too, and other such reasons.
Absolutely, well, I agree 100%. They shouldn't do that to kids. And that's why I don't think church and stuff is bad for children. But back then, it was a different time, I think. And maybe they still do it in some churches. I don't know. But that was definitely the wrong approach to show kids the end of the world, people screaming. And
well, at the time, we were dealing with the whole Cold War issue as well. And I do remember once one of my nieces, who are about 20 years younger than I am, coming to me and saying, Uncle Nathan, why are all the movies from the 80s America versus the Russians?
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
And they had no idea what the Cold War was. And I was like, well, basically, sweetie, we woke up every day wondering if we were going to get blown up. You know, that was how our days went. And, you know, I'm not quite as old as to remember Duck and Cover. But, you know, my last year of kindergarten, they were still practicing Duck, or my last year.
Duck and Cover.
Your last year. How many years did you spend in kindergarten?
Those 7 years I spent in kindergarten. The last year that they did Duck and Cover, I was in kindergarten. So I did actually have to participate in Duck and Cover. But, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of those things that you hear about and people just who didn't live through it don't understand. And that's one of those generation gap things that I never thought I'd be the guy going, kids today just don't understand.
Yeah, you know? They don't get it.
No, I turned into that guy. I sit on the front porch and yell at the kids to get off the lawn. And
then I run away. Yeah, so it's fine. Yes. I borrow
but, something about the end of the world, the Christian stuff that they talk about, they did hit the mark of the beast. And a lot of those videos, like that one, the guy would go up there and they're like, will you take the mark? And he'd say, no, I won't. So they would have him beheaded. They'd kill the guy. You know, that's how it was in the movie.
Well, that's from Revelations that you'll be beheaded. And a lot of people think it will be the return of the guillotine. But, you know, I think we're capable of some really nasty stuff these days. So if it does come about, who knows how they'll take your head off. They might have lightsabers by then to take your head off.
See, how do we know that the 666 ain't already in our skin somehow? How do we know? You know, it could have been an injection. The government, you could go for a vaccination and they could have put a chip inside.
If you follow the Revelation scripture, Sean, you would have to accept it. You would have to know what it was and accept it, so...
Right. Well, I don't think...
Trouble, that's a fine print when you sign credit cards now. Yes. Sorry, I let you guys know that. If you ever, they're very, very bottom line of a credit card you sign up for, you accept the sign of the beast. It's very small print, but you can see it there.
There is a phobia. There is a phobia of 666, is there not? I don't remember.
I believe there is.
Whatever the Latin word is for six times three is the thing.
We read the story on the show. They're talking about putting your credit card chip inside your hand to prevent theft. Do you remember we read that, Nathan?
Yep, and a lot of people, especially people who follow the Armageddon theories, do believe that's the beginning of the 666 fear.
Yeah. Although I did meet he was a priest, and I met him. I was actually traveling around. He lived in San Francisco, I think, at one point, but I met him in his travels. You actually can do a search in Google for this guy. He actually goes about how 666 isn't from the Bible and where it possibly came from and all these ideas. You know, it was that one person's dream. And he actually, his goal in life was to have people realize that 666 isn't as bad a number. It's just made up and been kind of and if you go and search on Google, look for I forget what his name is now. He's a pastor of 666. He has a big white Cadillac with the license plate 666. He has all this stuff trying to show.
I just found the phobia, and somebody from the chat room just put it up there. It's hexahexaphobia. Hexahexaphobia. Yeah.
Hexahexaphobia. Yeah.
Well, and you know,
three hexes.
One of the things I had to do while taking theology classes was study biblical numerology, And, you know, you have to know what the different numbers mean. And because the actual line in the Bible is, if any man has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for his number is 666. Well, if you actually look at the way biblical numerology works, the number 6 is the number of man, the number 3 is the number of God, and so 3 sixes is man trying to become God.
Right.
And if you
we got another one right out of the Belfast Telegraph, UK. You guys want to hear?
Sure.
Exorcism: Irish family flees house after son flung from bed. Here we go. We're going to jump right in, guys. This happened last week. An exorcism will be performed on a council house in the Republic of Ireland tonight amid claims that it is haunted. The occupants of the house at Holly Hill on Cork's north side have fled, saying it is occupied by an evil spirit that is determined to keep them out. Laura Burke, her partner Richie, and her son Kyle are terrified to remain after a spat of bizarre occurrences over the recent weeks. The young couple moved into the house last August. Today, special prayers will be said at the house to get rid of the spirits, and a New Age shaman, spirit worker, will perform an exorcism. I love that when they put it in parentheses. New Age shaman, spirit worker, will perform an exorcism. Laura said holy pictures were routinely being knocked from the wall, screams were heard in the dead of night, and their son was flung from his bed. The family received their greatest shock when they spotted what they described as glowing orbs hovering in midair. Could be something to the orbs, guys. It could be making a comeback. Hovering in midair in certain rooms in the house. It's an evil spirit. I don't believe it means us well, said Laura. We tried saying prayers in the house, and the next thing all you hear is banging furniture upstairs or clothes being fired out of wardrobes. Clairvoyant John O'Reilly was invited to inspect the house. He said he immediately felt a presence, adding, there is someone here. Someone who is very angry. I get a feeling of a younger man who would have hung himself. However, locals remain doubtful about the haunting claims and said nobody recalls previous incidents at the house or any tragedy fitting the descriptions being cited.
Well, right off the bat, I don't trust him because he doesn't know that the past tense of hang is hanged, not hung.
Hanged. Well, that's Ireland, man. They're on a different thing.
His name is John O'Reilly from Ireland. Come on.
John O'Reilly. Well, apparently, guys, the men in back. Back. The men in black.
Ooh,
are
hello,
back.
Nurse.
The men parts, in, huh? That's right. The men in black are back with a vengeance. Long whispered of the UFO lore reports the shadowy agents of the unknown are suddenly on the upswing throughout the U.S. It's rather disconcerting. Says paranormal expert Dr. Roy Timothy, 55, the phenomena is nothing like those men in black comedy films. The reality is much more strange and sinister. According to research, MIB activity is up an astounding 150% so far this year. The implications are quite disturbing. Typically, the MIB arrive at your home of a UFO witness shortly after the person reports his or her experience to the authorities. The MIB almost always comes in twos. Are always male and always wear black business suits, hence their name. It says Althea B's, a fictional name, is being used as the witness requested. Case is typical. In March, the unmarried 48-year-old elementary school teacher, a resident of New York State, saw a huge boomerang-shaped UFO zip past her secluded home near the Catskill Mountains. She called the police immediately. The next afternoon, Althea, two men in black suits, knocked at my door. They said they were government agents. They seemed like they were for real, so I let them in. The two men proceeded to ask the teacher detailed questions about her UFO sighting. There was something odd about these men, she says. Says the teacher. I always mess up a good story here. One did all the talking. The other barely said a word. At one point, the one who talked took out a small pad and asked me for a writing implement. As he put it, I handed him a click pen, and he looked at it like he had never seen one before. On the way out, they told me it would be wise not to talk to anyone about my sighting. It sounded vaguely threatening. UFO investigator Roger Nadd has looked into numerous MIB cases throughout the U.S. There's a compelling consistency to people's stories, says Nadd. Witnesses always report a weird sense of unease when they encounter the MIB. The suggestion seems to be that these things are not human beings. If the MIB are aliens, the fact that they tried to frighten people into silence and the fact that they're popping up more and more often tells me that something big is about to happen. So they're back. The Men in Black are popping up everywhere. They say this year alone, MIB activity is up 150%.
Do you know, really? Last show, remember we were having tech problems? We always joke around with the black helicopters?
Yeah.
Well, last show, if you're listening, all of a sudden I got very quiet again. It wasn't because I was being quiet, because, you know, I can. It was because the moment the guests came on, everyone's voice started getting really out of sync on my machine. I'm like, that's kind of weird. The speed to my internet dropped like a rock. It went back up and down a couple times, and then my software went down, like completely crashed, as a couple other things were crashing at the same time. Right. The moment that goes on, my dog, who's this little Boston Terrier guy, jumps up, starts growling at the door, runs to the front door. Like, in all one shot, things are falling down, things are going off, and we were joking about black helicopters, and I was half expected at that point in time that I was going to have a knock on the door and a man in black was walking in. I was actually nervous. I'm like, the dog's barking, things going off. I'm like, what did I get myself into?
Hey, we have made comments on this show while speaking to people in Russia and made jokes about the fact that the KGB is still in operation and been disconnected from our guest in Russia.
We have. Yes, we have.
So
it was bad on my end. I was certainly a little paranoid at one point.
Yeah.
So yeah, I blame you guys.
You should. Yeah, well, we're going to get you in trouble on this show, man.
Too late. I've been in trouble with you guys enough. I got arrested with Nathan one time there. I'm sure you and I, Sean, get together next time. We'll have fun. We'll have all the good stories when we're in prison.
I'm just going to wear my black business suit the next time and show up at Magnus's hotel room and knock on the door.
That's what we should do. You'd freak out, though. I mean, if you were doing this show and all of a sudden two guys in black suits showed up at your door and said, we need to speak to you about yesterday's show, you'd be like, what? You'd flip out, dude.
I'd be on the floor. He's like, well, let me talk to you in the hospital because I'm going to have a heart attack right now.
Yeah,
you know? I think I'm a little oblivious, and I'd be like, okay, do you need an autograph? What do you need?
autograph. Yeah, we need your autograph, all right? Sign here. It says never to talk to these people again. But, it's all kinds of stuff going on, man. You got the possible new human ancestor found in Siberia. That came out last week. It was a big story. This comes out of Washington. Genetic material pulled from a pinky finger bone found in a Siberian cave shows a new and unknown type of pre-human lived alongside modern humans and Neanderthals. Scientists report on Wednesday the creature nicknamed Woman X for the time being could have lived as recently as 30,000 years ago and appears only distantly related to modern humans or Neanderthals. The researchers reported it really just looked like something we have never seen before. Johann Cross of the Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, told a telephone briefing. It was a sequence that looks something like humans, but really quite different. The sequence indicates the homonyms line diverged about a million years ago from the line that gave rise to both humans and Neanderthals and that split about 500,000 years ago. That makes it younger than Homo erectus, the pre-human that spread out of Africa too much of the world about 1.9 million years ago. And it says it is some new creature that has not been on our radar screen so far, said Savat Pabo, a colleague of Cross's who specializes in analyzing ancient DNA, and it would have lived near to both modern humans and Neanderthals. There were at least three different forms of humans in this area 40,000 years ago, Pabo says.
Well,
yeah,
you know,
so I thought that was very interesting.
It's very interesting because they say that art imitates life, but sometimes life imitates art. And if you were a Battlestar Galactica fan, as I was, you know that when they ended Battlestar Galactica, a similar sort of storyline popped up. So, you know, look at that. And that's a year ago that came into effect. So,
I'm actually very impressed with this story. It shows a lot of how the theories that, you know, back in the day, we're a member of the great apes and how great apes, you know, existed. There's a lot of them back then. I mean, a lot of large, you know, variations. And they're showing that the possibility of, you know, humans interbreeding with them, either creating a you know, viable offspring or not, that could be, you know, either how we took over as well as we did. We either adapted some of their genetics or bred them out of existence. But this is just a great story to that it. It's always great when it expands science knowledge of things. Well, like, hey, wait a minute, this is big.
That's true. I mean, I've read the reports as well of, you know, the possibility of humans and chimpanzees interbreeding.
There was a Russian, I was just reading an article the other day about that. But right. There was a Russians.
But he was actually using, what are the red apes?
Orangutans. He had orangutans because he had, I actually just watched the whole thing on it yesterday, of all things. And yep. They had... originally he was going to try to, he brought, males of humans down to Africa and he used their semen to impregnate chimpanzees and that didn't work. And, when he went back to Russia, the animal that he could find available was the orangutan.
Which if he had used the chimpanzees, they said he might've had a better chance.
Yeah, it's definitely not much closer. I mean, orangutans are off another branch, the same branch like gorillas went from. We're closer to like, you know, bonobos and those sort of things. It's actually funny because they're talking about a possible, you know, those humanzees, they call them, with, what was it, Oliver. The character, there's a chimpanzee that was found, you know, that they kind of became known about having this human characteristics. Had pointed ears, which is actually not characteristic of either species, but it had a chromosomal difference between chimpanzee. It walked upright. It was still living up until a couple of years ago. They did some tests on it. I think they had AIDS at one point too. It was went to a research facility right. too, but it definitely was brought the idea that maybe it was a human chimpanzee. So
it's kind of like when you get into the genetic necessity that you find in like tapeworms and things like that. You know, these things have no idea, no brains to speak of, yet they can control the brains of the people and animals they get into to make the people and animals act in such a way that they will be able to breed easier.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go back to where they believe that at one point Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal were interbreeding, they mm-hmm. kind of think we got the gene for beards from the Neanderthal simply because men wanted to cover up the genetic flaw that comes with having a weak chin. And so because having a strong chin is a genetic trait that would be more acceptable by a female. So by growing the beard.
So it's sexual selection, not like cognitive thought pattern, right. really. Just kind
sexual selection. And therefore... having a weak chin makes you less likely to be a mate, and having a strong chin would make you more likely to have a mate. So they would grow beards to make them more sexually attractive, which, you know, why I have the beard and all. But
hello there.
Hello.
Yeah. Actually, this is a great topic because we're coming in from this, going to be talking to about the Star Child stuff, and we're doing half and half from alien, you know, we're alien humans. We're going to be leading into this way, so you know, it's be great. Half chimp, now we have aliens. Same.
But my question with the half aliens, one of the ones I'm looking forward to speaking to Mr. Pye about tonight is, you know, why are there so few examples of a possible crossbreed between alien and human? So that will definitely be a question worth asking this evening.
You know, I actually have a great question I want to ask, and there's no answer to it because it's such an odd theory. But in regards, because I watched the Star Child events. He's been like on BBC America, Discovery Channel, I think, something else too. Because I've seen this skull quite a bit, and the theory. Because I mean, I studied the tests myself. I looked at it, the ones they had in his reports, and all the findings I said. It looks like it shows it's, you know, the mitochondrial DNA shows its mother is human. The DNA, the other, you know, extraneous nuclear stuff was showing that it has human. Not only is it human, but both its parents were human. But the theory I've been liking, I was reading about, is that what is chance that, you know, the aliens aren't aliens, but aliens are time travelers from the future kind of thing. And they're using this information showing that it actually was a hybrid between a future human with the Greys are thought to be in this theory and a human of this era. So it's kind of a fun theory that popped up. I was reading about off of all the forums about the Star Child thing. It's very cool.
Oh, did we lose Sean? I guess we lost Sean. Hold on. I thought it was getting quiet there.
You give him a call back. I'll keep rambling. I talk too much. He's like, oh, this is boring. I'm going.
Let's see how we... unfortunately, you know, I have the system set up so that And Sean's trying to call in, which means now he won't be able to... There we go. There we go.
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you.
It's the Men in Black, baby. I'm
I tell you. I will tell you. It's a very big possibility. There's no way to call in once I log into the system. So Sean had to wait for me to call him back, and I didn't see you were off the line there, Sean.
What's that?
I didn't see you were off the line because you can't call in once I'm logged in.
Well, there you go.
So it's and I see you tried to even chat me, and I'm wasn't watching that. I'm a bad host this evening.
You're on it today, buddy.
I tell you.
It's all the chocolate he's been eating. He's on a candy
high. We got a good
guest.
We got Johnny in the house, crypto fanatic. John, Big John boy. We got him. He's going to have some knockdown questions tonight. I think we are going to learn a lot, man,
now,
about the Star Child.
Now, skull. John, as a cryptozoologist and alternate species fan...
Non-sexually speaking.
What would the Star Child fall under cryptozoology? Or would it be...
When it's going into the human range, it's kind of not so much... I mean, technically it's cryptozoology and the idea that humans are part of the zoological world where we put ourselves separate from it all the time. But this one is interesting to me more in the sense of if, just human hybridization, because I think that's an area that research doesn't get into enough. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's really cryptozoology, but freaky science.
I saw that movie when I was a kid.
That's weird science.
Weird science.
Sorry.
Very good movie. I like it. How much time do we got here, guys?
We've got 3 minutes, Sean. 3 minutes.
Oh, my God. Time's just dragging by tonight, huh?
Oh, yeah.
That's what happens. Hang around with me. It's like a painful thing. Time slows down.
Hey, I got one for you guys. Harry Potter author on pervert registry. Yeah. Oh, you Harry Potter.
J.K. Rowling? Really?
Harry Potter's author, J.K. Rowling, must register as a possible sex offender in a new program aimed to protect school children. Any adult, including the famous writer who comes in contact with the children, must register on a national database intended to protect children from pedophiles. Called the Vetting and Bearing Scheme, VBS, authors such as Rowling.
It's either way. We'll say it's an accent if you say it wrong. Don't worry about it.
Let's call her Woman X. Rowling. And Philip Pullman of the fantasy trilogy, His Dark Material, must join the registry if they plan to visit any school. The VBS was set up in 2002 after the tragic murders of Jessica Chapman and Holly Wells by a janitor at their school. While the novelists agree that such a database makes sense, they object to having their names publicly placed with sexual predators. Pullman called the policy poisonous and went on to say that it teaches children that they should regard every adult as a potential murderer or rapist. That's not good.
Just because they visit schools, they have to be on this list?
They wanted to put them on this list, but it's not the list we're thinking of. It's not the sexual predators
list. So it's not
list.
Like it's, the United States Megan Law list.
Right. It's called the VBS. So it would be the Vetting and Barring Scheme.
That's such a weird – why keep making up lists and breaking stuff apart? I mean – yeah, because all I can think of now, if she's on a list, I'm like, maybe that's the reason she kept writing about children and their wands.
Oh.
Success. Hogwarts. Author Anthony Horowitz of the Alex Rider Adventure in the Power of Five series said simply, the law was made by people with a twisted view of society, and such people should not be making laws. Oh. And that's all they got to say on that. So I'm thinking she's not going to go to this school anytime soon because they're up in arms about it.
Now, can she go to Hogwarts, or is that just not allowed either?
I think you can't touch kids at Hogwarts either, man.
I don't know. That one got – never mind.
I'm getting a text from Lloyd Pye saying it's 10 past his time. So.
Oh, okay. Well, let's let us. I'm used to doing quarter after, Sean. I didn't realize he was at 10. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we will have Lloyd Pye. Text him back. Tell him we'll be back in 5 minutes.
You got it.
We'll be right back after this.
The Darker Side of the Moon is an alternative talk variety show.
DarkerSideRadio.com.
Since 2006, host Becky Ray and Laura Moon speak with independent filmmakers, authors, musicians, artists, and many, many more.
DarkerSideRadio.com.
Sometimes serious, mostly fun, the show has a little for everyone.
DarkerSideRadio.com.
Was it odd, freaky, and you didn't hear it on the 5 o'clock news? Then we'll probably cover it here.
DarkerSideRadio.com.
Darker Side currently airs live Monday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, which is 7 p.m. Central and 5 p.m. Pacific.
DarkerSideRadio.com.
If you happen to miss it, you can listen to show archives at any time online at DarkerSideRadio.com, or you may subscribe to the show on iTunes.
DarkerSideRadio.com.
Right now, like to thank you for
Hey, this is Nathan S. of the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show. When we needed a logo that would tell people what we were all about but was different from anything else out there, we went right to Loki Graphics at LokiGraphicsInc.com. We love the artwork that owner and illustrator Jonathan Sullivan came up with so much, we ordered our t-shirts and banners from Loki Graphics right away. They provided us with high-quality graphic art, screen printing, and helped us pick out the best value for our t-shirts and other products that fit our budget. LokiGraphicsInc.com is the official graphic designer and screen printer for the Ghostman and Demon Hunter show. Phone, email, and postal orders are all accepted, with contact information available on their website. Shipping is available for any order, or if you're local, you can stop by the shop and pick up your finished product. Check out Loki Graphics at LokiGraphicsInc.com and tell them the Ghostman and Demon Hunter sent you.
Hey, this is Josh Hawley from Tombstone Ghost Hunters. Don't forget to listen to the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show, and don't forget to read Tombstone's Most Haunted. All you heathens and hooligans, come on and get the hell
out of here. Bum, 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 bum. Yes.
Hey,
we
brother.
We are back. I tell you, the black helicopters, man, they're cutting me out tonight.
Oh, man. I'll tell you, that song, we didn't mention that was from Engineering the Enemy, Alone Again. And that you found that on GarageBand.com.
That's right. If you want to check out that band, guys, go to GarageBand.com. Make sure you told them the Ghostman and Demon Hunter show sent you. But we got a very special guest tonight. And I want to ask you guys a question out to all our listeners. Have aliens walked among us? I want you guys to think about that. And if they have, do they still to this day? And you got to start thinking throughout this show. It possibly aliens and humans may have made it. In the past, we don't know, but that's why we got very special guest, author of Starchild Skull Essentials, researcher and keeper of the skull, Mr. Lloyd Pies, in the house tonight. Lloyd, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Happy Easter, yes.
Yeah, thank you. Happy Easter to you as well.
Well, I tell you, I got about a book of information in front of me, Lloyd. I've been trying to go over and stay with you here on a lot of this, because the book is very easy to read, The Essentials, Starchild Skull Essentials, and it's a very easy read, and I would say anybody go get it right now, because it's a great book. But there's been a lot of testing and stuff done on the skull, and I can't even begin to try to understand. I
think first thing is to make sure people understand what the Starchild Skull is, and I mean, maybe a lot of people know exactly what it is, and so maybe just ask right away.
Well, yeah, that is a good place to start. It is, for those who have not heard of it, it is a real, true bone skull. Nobody doubts that. Many, many scientists have dealt with it, and they all agree that you know, it's an actual, real skull, mm-hmm. not cobbled together, not faked or frauded in any way. So we start with that as the beginning point. It was found in 1930 in Mexico, by a girl who assumed, as anybody would at that time, that it was just a deformed human. And so she kept it as a souvenir of her trip to Mexico.
Now, it was like, originally came out of, like, it was found inside of mine, like,
inside
right in Mexico, right?
Right?
It was inside of mine, and it was it with another skeleton as well, like a human skeleton?
Exactly, with another skeleton.
And so it wasn't like it was dug up. I'm just saying where it originally came from. So it wasn't like dug up from someplace, or it was kind of discovered. Literally, people walking in a
right.
mine.
They were buried. Those two skeletons were there 900 years ago, plus or minus 40 years, according to carbon-14 testing from two mm-hmm. different labs at two different times. So we can be pretty sure that that's an accurate story that she told, that she described, finding them both buried together and entwined. So it was pretty clear they died together. So anyways, the two skulls came to the States, to El Paso, Texas, and she kept them her whole life as her souvenirs. And when she found out she was dying in the early 90s, she willed them to another couple, and that couple kept them 5 years and then gave them to another couple. And that couple, Ray and Melanie Young, in late 98, realized that it wasn't what everybody had thought up to that point. It wasn't a human deformity. Melanie had been a neonatal nurse for many years.
Okay.
And she knew immediately it didn't have any of the hallmarks of a standard human deformity. It was very, very different in a number of ways, technical ways. So not only that, she and her husband Ray were members of the El Paso MUFON branch of MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. So they also knew a lot about aliens. So putting two and two together, they looked at the skull, felt it, felt how light it was, and Melanie could see how its shape was completely different from a normal human, and she felt it could be the skull of a gray alien. That was her working assumption. So they decided to ask me if I would try to determine scientifically what it was, and when they showed it to me, I thought it was interesting, but I had to assume that it was indeed some kind of deformity. The odds on it actually being a gray alien to me were just, you know, impossible. So for a year, I took it around to, for all of 1999, this was in February of 99, they showed it to me, and I took it around to a wide range of specialists, finding the few that would talk to me out of the many that would not. And when I would listen to them one by one, they began to give me different parts, explain different parts, how this could not be human. I don't know about the rest of it, but I can tell you that what I'm looking at, what I know about, this really can't be a normal human kind of deformity.
And the, you approached them with the idea, I mean, do you approach them with, I have a skull here doing research, or do you approach them with, I have an unknown skull? How did you bring it to them?
At first, I would just say, I've got a very unusual skull here. I'd like you to tell me what you can about it. Mm-hmm. And they would generally always say, oh, well, fine, bring it in. And then some of them would get a look at it, and they would just say, oh, no, that's a cradle board at hydrocephalic. I really don't need to say any more about that. It's very common. Take it away. You know, they just basically show me the door, and those are the ones that, you know, they knew what it was. And so, I mean, they knew how weird it was, if anything. So then some of them would say, wow, this is really interesting, you know, and let me take a look at that. And so they would tell me, and it's, sometimes they let me use their names and other times not. You know, it can be a third rail in science if you it's found out that you have any opinions at all that are serious about UFOs or aliens. So
now you were saying that before that they said it was cradle boarding. For our listeners out there, cradle boarding is when the soft skull of the child is left on its back and the back of the skull flattens out.
Well, not exactly that. They have to tie the head down. So for mothers in primitive societies that have to work shortly after childbirth and through childbirth, I mean through infanthood, they have to strap the baby. They have to carry the baby some way, whether it's a sling pouch or on their backs in a
okay.
Like a yeah, so it's like a backpack that when
it's like
being bound up, there's
a
the board's just, it's just the baby's kind of molded into this press board as they're being added
you go
into
to the
life groove. So.
Yeah, if you go to the Star Child website, starchildproject.com, the human that was found with the Star Child was indeed cradleboarded. So you look at her head, it was a female, and you see what an actual real cradleboard looks like, and you see how small the area of flattening is in a normal human compared to how massive it is in the Star Child. And also, with cradleboarding, the bone of an infant is so soft, it actually flattens as flat as the board. I mean, it is absolutely flat. That human skull that you see there, you rub your fingers across the flat part, it's as flat as a table, flat as a piece of glass. You do that with a Star Child, and you feel natural convolutions and little bumps and you know, ins and outs all the way over the whole area of flattening. So it's natural flattening. It's clearly not cradleboarded.
Now, what's the difference between cradleboarding and an infant, and then, like, what's that? Isn't in that culture, like, in the Andes or something, the Indian mountains, that they adjust their head? What's it doing?
Necks.
It's called head.
No, the head binding for the their.
That's a reshaping. We, you know, our flathead Indians did it, and a lot of cultures do that. And
does that texture have anything different? I mean, a child just kind of pressed in boards, everything else, versus something that's been cradled to a purpose? Is there a difference?
You, when you cradle board, you only flatten the rear of the head.
Yes.
When you head bind to reshape the head, you put boards or you put bands, tight bands of cloth or something all around the head to actually reshape it, to deliberately reshape it. And that's
correct.
Done by some cultures, but there's no evidence of that in the Star Child.
Lloyd, did you ever find out the age of the bones?
Well, the human was in her late 30s to early 40s when she died, just based on wear patterns of the teeth, the degree of suturing of her skull. This is what the experts estimate. You can't tell any other way. The star child was initially thought to be a child. The first test that we did was a series of x-rays, and what we found was with the maxilla, the piece of maxilla, that detached maxilla that goes with it, that's the upper part of your jaw, the upper right part. It had two teeth present. You could see three teeth were missing. And in the upper part of the bone, in the upper part of the maxilla, there were impacted teeth. So the x-ray tech says, oh, well, if you have teeth down and teeth up, it's got to be a kid 5 or 6 years old. And so we just started calling it the star child. Later we found out from experts that the teeth were too well worn to be from a child, and they were just, the roots were much thicker than a child's teeth would be. So it was an adult. The star child was an adult, but it was called the star child, and we just have stuck with
now,
that.
Now, is it possible, because I've heard you say that the skull itself is thinner than most skulls,
the
teeth were thinner as well?
Say again,
Were the teeth thinner as well?
They were smaller, but they weren't thinner, no. They were pretty tough teeth. Good teeth. The star child's bone is thinner. It's uniformly thinner by half to less than half of normal human bone thickness throughout the skull, but it's two or three times as hard. Its biochemistry is completely different from human bone. Its bone is more like tooth enamel, ironically enough. Its bone is very, very durable, very, very hard.
Now, are the teeth themselves where you got the DNA to test the mitochondrial DNA?
No, we didn't take it from the teeth. We took it from panels out of the top rear of the skull, out of the parietal bones. We took it out of there.
Has anybody tried to compare that DNA with the DNA of the other skeleton to see if maybe that there was a relation between
them? They both were tested in 2003. Their DNA was tested in 2003, and what we found was that the human, her mitochondrial DNA came up very easily on the first attempt, and her nuclear DNA came up very easily on the first attempt. And she was found to be from haplogroup A, which is just a common Mesoamerican group. The star child's mitochondrial DNA also pulled up very easily on the first attempt. And what this means is that the DNA is fresh and good and whole and not degraded. But when they attempted to recover the star child's nuclear DNA, mitochondrial DNA comes from only your mother's line, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, like that. It floats outside the nucleus. Inside the nucleus is all the DNA that comes from both your parents. That's the whole chromosomal package, 23 from mom, 23 from dad. So when we tried to recover the star child's nuclear DNA in 6 full attempts, the geneticists could not do it. They couldn't get a recovery. Now, this is using, at that time in 2003, human-only primers of several hundred to several thousand base pairs long, strings of base pairs, you know, like a chain, looking for its match-up links in the solution of DNA. So they couldn't find it. So what that meant was, since we knew that the mother was human because they had recovered the mitochondrial DNA, we knew that the father wasn't human, because if the father was human, then we would have been able to recover the star child's nuclear DNA, and that would have been the end of it right there in 2003. We've got a deformity no matter how all the physiology is different. If we would have recovered its nuclear DNA using human-only primers, that would have been the end of it. So because we couldn't, we knew that the father wasn't entirely human anyway. So then it became a question of, how do we prove this? We know it. How can we prove it? And the geneticist said, there is no way right now. You're going to have to wait 3 to 5 years until a new technology comes online that will allow the recovery of every single base pair in the star child's genome, every nucleotide. That's 3 billion approximately for a human being, a chimp, gorilla. So, there's nothing we could do. We just had to wait. Well, sure enough, That technology is now available, and it is within reach. It's a couple hundred thousand dollars, but that's recovering the whole thing. I know, it's very expensive. That's recovering the whole genome. But in the interim, recently we found a geneticist willing to work with us and to use the latest technology short of the full recovery techniques, which are called shotgunning. And in 203, all we had were primer lengths in the hundreds to low thousands of base pairs long. Now they can be much smaller, only a couple of hundred. So that's what he went looking for, and sure enough, he found it. He found both the star child's, found nuclear DNA, some of which was human, no question, as one would expect, and some of which, surprisingly, was not just non-human, but not found on Earth. And that's really the big news of late with the star child, that part and pieces of its DNA, of its base pair strings that have been recovered, are not from Earth, or at least not found on Earth to this point. And so it's very exciting. It tells us for sure that we're going to be able to make history with this thing.
Now
we're in the process of, you know, gathering the money and the expertise to do what needs to be done.
I'm sorry, Sean, go ahead.
We have a question, actually, Lloyd, from the chat room, and you're going to have to excuse my mispronunciation of this word. Can he comment on why he doesn't believe this to be a microcephalic skull?
Yep.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, that's a pretty easy one.
Yeah.
A microcephalic is a skull like, you know, JoJo, the pinhead boy, those kind of things. It's a small brain. It is a smaller than normal brain. It's a microcephalic, meaning smaller than normal brain. And the star child, in fact, has a brain that is fully one-third larger than a skull capacity of that size. That the star child skull is about the size of a standard 12-year-old or a very small adult human, like 5 foot or under. And so that should be about 1,200 cubic centimeters. You and I, if we're normal size people, we have about 1,400 cubic centimeters of brain. So the star child should have been in that 1,200 cubic centimeters of brain range, but actually it's 1,600 cubic centimeter range. So it's fully literally one third from, it should be 1,200 and it's 1,600. So it's fully one third more than it should be. And to tell you the truth, to this day, after 11 years, we still don't really understand how that much brain, that much extra brain fits in the skull. We really don't understand where it all goes, even now. It doesn't really make sense. The thinning of the brain would certainly add some volume, but let's say the inner ears are twice as large as they should be, so that takes a little bit away. The sinuses are missing, so that gives you more volume. The eye sockets are very, very shallow, so that gives you more volume. But still, it doesn't seem like a full 400 cubic centimeters.
Now, is there a natural occurring something that would cause? I mean, it may not just be a normal, you know, like hydrocephalic or something that way. It could be is there another human condition that could explain for this? Like, is it progeria or anything?
No, progeria. We get all these things all the time, and we've gone over them, you know, many, many times. Like, All disorders, guys, all like progeria, like hydrocephaly, like anything, all of that leaves the bone still human bone. Its biochemistry doesn't change and turn into tooth enamel, number one. Now, some of those things, like progeria, for example, you do get thinning of the crown of the head and thinning of some of the other bones, but the rest of it remains normal. The eye sockets remain the same depth. The neck, the foramen magnum, where the neck comes into the skull, that position of that remains the same. The knot that we all have at the rear of our head where our necks attach to our skulls, if you reach around to the back of your head, center of your head, a little bit lower than the midpoint, you'll feel a knot there. That's called the inion or the external occipital protuberance. Everything with a head on a neck has one of those, where the neck connects with the head.
Random factoid for anyone listening here. Actually, I have an extremely large occipital protuberance. My doctor actually, I've actually been diagnosed. I have like a lump. If you ever look at me next time I'm at a show or something, I have a big lump in the back of my head, and I actually have an extreme occipital protuberance.
Yeah, it can be various size, but everybody has one. The star child has a dimple, kind of a dimple there. It's concave rather than convex.
So I'm the anti-star child.
So it's very, very, you know, very unusual. Star child has no sinuses. Most of those disorders that you talk about doesn't take the sinuses away. So it's still a human being. Its DNA will test out as human. It'll have the flaws that cause it to be not human. Not perfect, but it's still going to be human DNA. As far as we can tell, the star child's DNA, part of it is going to prove out to be not entirely, not human, not just not human, but not found on Earth.
Now,
so that's what makes the star child different, really different.
I have a question for you, Lloyd.
Sure.
The world of the paranormal over the last decade has changed. Used to be we all went out, we tried to find things and show whether or not, they were paranormal in origin. Now everybody wants the skeptic view as well. Are you making the skull available to people who want to say, I think this is a human skull, and not just making the results available to them, but making the DNA results and everything like that available to people to also be able to say one way or another what they feel about the skull?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Once we have everything lined up that we can do in terms of recovering the entire genome, then that research and that, I'm sure, will be made available. The results will be made available, because one of the things we intend to do is film the process as it unfolds. Well, that's part of the money that we have to raise, is to film the process. Because if ever a scientific experiment has to be covered stem to stern by film, this is it, so that nobody can say, oh, well, you got a result that we don't agree with. That means you must have done something wrong. There must have been some fiddling with the results or whatever. So we're going to have to just make really, really sure that everything is covered and is made as transparent and as visible as it can be, so that there's no question of how the results were arrived at and what the results are.
That's just intrigues me about the star child. I guess where I'm most fascinated by is this is a hybrid. This was an alien and a human creating this. This is what we think, right?
Don't make that mistake. It's so different. The physiology of it is so different, and it's looking like the genetics of it are so different. You can't think in terms of a sexual union. You're going to have to think in terms of genetic manipulation and in vitro, you know, putting it together in vitro and then implanting it. This is not done. You don't see like you would a horse and a donkey produces a mule. It isn't like that. There's enough in that mule to where you can see donkey and you can see horse. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
It's not like that with the star child. You don't see any human.
Now,
all the human is gone.
Now, we can also look at this in such a way that we're jumping to conclusions no matter what, because for all we know, this could have been a situation where an egg was collected on Earth, then worked on a ship or however you want to think about it,
absolutely.
And then raised and then replanted on Earth to see how it managed on
Absolutely.
Earth.
Absolutely. That's almost certainly what happened, because you have those stories right now today going on. I've talked to at least a dozen women over the years who've come to me in tears and told me their story, where they swear up and down, I was taken on a ship, I was made pregnant, I came home, I had morning sickness, I went to the doctor, I had a sonogram, they saw my baby, and in the fourth month, they came and got it from me, and I woke up and I had every sign of a miscarriage, except there was no fetus, And I know they took it, and then they came back and they got me 5 years later, 7 years later, 8 years later, 10 years later. And I saw my kid. They told me that was my hybrid child, and I believed that it was. You know what I mean? And boy, why would they do that? And they get really emotional, and I believe them. I don't care what, I believe them. I don't believe, who would make that up for the fun of it? You know what I mean?
Sure, right.
So though, I think it's something along those lines, that the capacity to do this has been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and I suspect that the star child is going to prove out to be something like that. I don't believe it's going to be the result of a sexual union. It's just too physiologically different. There's just not enough human left in it to suspect that that might be the case.
Now, why is this the only star child skull that's been found?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's probably that program of creating those hybrids is very carefully watched over and watched after. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that there hasn't been more than one to slip through the cracks, but this is the only one that's been found as far as, you know, as far as anyone knows. And I assume that I get probably every weird skull photo out there comes my way. And I still haven't seen anything that, you know, really approaches the star child. Now, there are other weird skulls out there that I think are very much worthy of analysis. I mean, intense analysis, like genetic analysis, and that would be the coneheads of Peru. But there are a lot of them. There are hundreds of them.
They don't come from France?
No, they don't. These are not the ones from France. I think Aykroyd got that idea, or whoever it was at Saturday Night Live that came up with that, those characters, got it from a trip to Peru and seeing those skulls in the museums, because, like I said, they're there in just about every museum. They're a very common fact in Peru, and what makes them special is that their heads, instead of standing straight up like the ones on Saturday Night Live, they stick off to the rear of their heads, but they have double the size of the brains that we have. Earlier we were talking about normal humans have 1,400 cubic centimeters. The coneheads average from 2,800 to 3,000 cubic centimeters. Now, when you reshape a human head, they have very human-like faces, don't get me wrong, but when you reshape a human head, it doesn't double its brain. It just reshapes the volume of the brain that we normally have. But those brains, and they've done, you know, they have done enough x-ray analysis to know that the brains filled the heads. They weren't, you know, water on the brain or anything like that. That this is the way they all looked. They had this twice the size of a human brain in their head. Those are not, I'm sorry, but that's not human. So if they ever do any amount of detailed DNA analysis on them, I'm very confident they're going to prove out to be pretty doggone weird, too. And if I am successful with the star child as now, I really do believe I will be. One of the things I intend to do, if nobody's done it up to that point, is go down there and start working on the coneheads, because I think the results will be just as spectacular.
Hey, Lloyd, I got to ask you, with the star child, you know, he must have lived. The bones were discovered in Mexico, so they must have had been in a family or from a village or something like that. Has there been any cave drawings or anything like that about the star child that's anybody's found?
One of the unfortunate things about this is we do not know the village nor where the mine tunnel is that the woman found them, because what happened was when she found out she was dying in the early 90s, she just told the people that she passed them to, friends of hers, that it was about 100 miles southwest of Chihuahua, a village about 100 miles southwest of Chihuahua. That's all she said. And at the time, who could know that in 8 or 9 years it was going to be important exactly where?
Right.
So we just do not know where that is. Now, our hope is that somebody from her extended family may know where. And when this story gets enough notoriety worldwide, maybe they'll come forward and say, oh, yeah, that was Grandma so-and-so, and she got them in, you know, such and such a village, and then that'll help us to narrow it down. But to this point in time, that hasn't happened.
You know, there could still be villagers out there talking about the star child that's been passed down through the ages, the story.
It could be, but what happened was when she found them, she snuck them back into the state. So not many people know about it. She didn't toot it as, you know, as a big deal. She snuck them in and sort of kept them private her whole life. So they aren't widely known by anybody, really.
Now, are you worried at all, Lloyd, about the idea that, like in Egypt, if a mummy is discovered outside of Egypt, they immediately request that that mummy be returned as property to Egypt? Are you worried that Mexico might do this?
No, we're not worried. It's been, you know, it was done in 1930, well before there were any treaties or any laws or anything like that. And it's been 11 years, and I haven't heard beep from the Mexicans at all. So now, again, maybe when it becomes a worldwide thing, maybe we might start hearing from them. But I don't. They won't have a legal leg to stand on.
Okay.
Now, Lloyd, I kind of want to switch topics here just real quick. I read the news story earlier. I know this is old news, but possible new human ancestor found in Siberia. What was your thoughts on that?
Well, it's very interesting, and I think that it just shows how little science actually knows about anything relative to human origins and how we've come to be here. Because, you know, they've gone from, well, there's just humans, you know, the Cro-Magnons, and then there's Neanderthals, and, you know, we're going to try to shoehorn those in as another kind of human. But as they've unfolded its genome, they found that it's very different. It's well over 3 billion base pairs, and they're having a hard time figuring out what to say about Neanderthals. And then the hobbits came along 17,000 years ago, and now you've got this new one on top of that. What they don't want to do, what they don't want to acknowledge, and they work very hard against, is accepting that the possibility that these are hominoids, which is Bigfoot, Yeti, you know, the abominable snowman, those kinds of creatures. This is another area of interest and expertise for me. The world is actually populated by these creatures living in almost half of the arable land of the earth. Now, I know it shocks everybody when they hear that, but the truth of it is about half of the earth is still covered by environments that humans are not comfortable in, that we don't really live in, that we don't thrive in. And so we live maybe at the edges near, but and maybe drive roads through these places, but thick forests, jungles, swamps, things like that, where humans live very, very sparsely, if they live at all. That's where these things live. And for hundreds of years, legends of small pygmy-type-sized hair-covered creatures. On this particular island, they're known as Ibogogo, and they're all over the equator, around in the band of jungles that circle the equator. Every area has their own name for their little pygmy type. That's what a hobbit is. Well, science doesn't want to, you know, acknowledge that. Russia, the type that's known and common in Russia, are Almas.
The Almas, yeah.
They are human. They are human-sized. Almas, Almasti. There are a number of names there, but we call them Almas in general. So that's what science is trying to avoid. So they're going to try to shoehorn this into some new kind of human, when in fact probably this thing is just nothing more than the finger bone of a hominoid, and that's why its mitochondrial DNA was so different.
Wow. When you're talking about, actually, I want to have one factoid back here. When you're talking about people thinking how anything could not exist nowadays, when given an example of how much is known about, or the like, wilderness versus, you know, servable land, Africa has about 24% like true wilderness, 24%. And Africa, you think that's a deep, scary continent, doesn't know anything else. Where North America, we actually are 38 to 39 to 40% ultimate wilderness, still unknown. And we are the U.S. We have Google Maps. We think that stuff is still not documented. So,
well, if you take away the desert, that's half of Africa. You see what I mean? It puts that number in perspective. But with us, and we have some desert area too, but not nearly as much. But yeah, there are parts of the swamps of Louisiana where I'm from that, you know, Cajuns will go in their little pirogues, go through the bayous, but they don't live there. They live, you know, they live where it's comfortable to live. You can go in the Panamint Mountains of Nevada and Utah, and they say that there are wild camels running loose there from the Civil War. And all through the North and Canada, the North Woods of Canada and Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, people drive, you know, put roads through there, but they don't really live up in the deep heart of those places. That's where these creatures have plenty of room to live without ever seeing, laying eyes on a human being.
So, hey, if you see a car, you just stand back for a second because the car drives on another 400 miles in another direction. Yeah, there's nothing in those roads.
They just can, and they can travel. They can travel through those woods up and down. I mean, when you really look at how the Earth is laid out, it's very, very surprising, and it isn't at all what you think. It really isn't.
Hey, Lloyd, do you think this is where we get the leprechauns, the gnomes, stuff like that from? People are seeing these different species, and they're just calling them gnomes and stuff?
No, I think that they're, you know, I think people who live in the more primitive people who are living every day in and out in their environment, not like us. We're living in our apartments, in our houses, in our cars. We are really separated from the earth around us, from the land around us, from existence around us. But you get in more primitive cultures where you have got to be on your toes 24/7 to just not get eaten by something, you know.
Right.
When those people see something, they know what they're seeing. And then when they describe it, that's why hominoids are described the same around the world, no matter how primitive that person is. And many times they've never read a book, they've never been to school, but they know the world around them. And when they tell you what they're seeing, you know, some primitive type person from the other side of the world will say the same thing. So that gives great credence to the stories about hominoids. I would say the same things about, you know, the leprechauns, gnomes, and all that, because there's a consistency to those stories as well. I think those have more likely are based on encounters with aliens, not hominoids.
Now, Lloyd, this is more of a hypothetical question. But you said the Star Child was an adult, actually.
Yes.
Is it possible that the Star Child may have bred and that there are people in Mexico with Star Child DNA? Or do you think it would be like a mule where it would be unable to breed?
I think it would be, it wouldn't necessarily not have sexual organs or anything like that, but it could well be like a mule that is sterile. You know, mm-hmm. You get a donkey and a horse and you get a mule, but the mule is sterile, it can't make more mules. It could be like that. I doubt that there are people running around in Mexico that have any kind of direct descendants from not just the Star Child, but any of these hybrid people. I think probably the reason that this program seems to be being carried out by whoever is carrying it out is that the hybrids that they produce are sterile, and so they have to keep making more. That's just my guess.
Now, Sean, I forget my question that I wanted to ask, but I remembered you had a question regarding futuristic people.
Oh, with my question, it was kind of a funnier thing. It's just there's a theory. I don't know if you were. I actually was on one of your web boards. I was following you on after you were on the Discovery Channel, I believe. It was about idea that it's not an alien from in the sense of another planet, everything else, but the theory was of having a time travelers having. It was the concept of the future us coming back and getting stronger genetics for the future again. And that was actually, I saw that on some of your boards there.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of theories put out to explain it. And that's one of them, for certainly, that the Star Child represents a human from the future, from the far future, come back and lost in time and couldn't get out of the time travel or machine or whatever. That's one theory. Another theory is that it is actually an example of beings that live under the earth or under the sea. That there are, you know, there are people who believe that there are whole civilizations and cultures living underground and under the sea. So there's evidence for that. There's actually good evidence for both of those theories. So it's hard to rule anything out, although I'm just inclined to believe that this is probably more an example, since we have these stories and we have a lot of them, of human women claiming that they're made pregnant and that they're hybridized in some way. or they become part of making a new creature. And in here we've got one that looks kind of like it might well be one of those. So I'm going to go with that theory for the time being until it's proved otherwise, if it ever will be proved otherwise. I don't know.
Now, we've had a question from the chat room from Jerry, actually, and it says it goes back to the red that was found on the skull, the Star Child skull.
You're talking about the red residue in the can.
The red residue, yeah. They wanted to know if you found anything else about that.
No, we have a problem with both the red residue and the fibers also found in woven through the matrix of the bone are these very durable fibers, and we don't really know what either the fibers or the red residue are. Neither thing should be there. So it's pretty clear that this is a highly unusual aspect of the Star Child. But the problem is, because it's never been seen before in any other bone on Earth, either thing, either the fibers or the red residue, in that way after death, because bacteria clean out all the cancellous holes. So there's no protocols for recovering it. It's microscopic in size, very, very small in size. So there are no protocols for recovering it. Not to say that such protocols can't be invented. I mean, you know, they can suck one sperm into a pipette and insert it into an egg, and it can do a lot of things at the microscopic level. But what we would have to pay for first are the protocol, the development of the protocols to make those recoveries, and then we would have to pay for whatever testing could be devised to test these materials that nobody knows what they are. So when it was put to me, you know, hey, you're really biting off a huge, huge expense here if you go for this, we can barely make ends meet, you know, so I just never was able to do it. Not that I don't want to do it, not that I don't think it won't be done in the future once we prove with the DNA what it is. I think everything about the Star Child is going to be known by science. Once it's okay for science to accept that it's real and legitimate, then I think they're going to just be lining up and begging for parts of it to study. Which is, you know, it'll be, you know, the Iceman. Remember when they found the frozen
in Italy?
Neolithic man, yeah, exactly, under the glacier in Italy. And they've spent, what, $30 million doing, I mean, absolutely everything you could think of on this guy. Well, it'll be like that with the Star Child. Once it's okay, once they don't have to look over their shoulders at their scornful peers saying, what, you believe in UFOs and aliens? Once we can wipe those guys out and just say, hey, look, they're real, everybody get used to it, well, then it'll be okay, and there'll be all kinds of research done on it. And I'm sure that the red residue and the fibers will be at the head of the list of trying to figure out what this thing's all about.
Now, do you think... I'm sorry, I just want to ask this really quick. If you think you took the UFO and alien aspect out of the equation and asked for help to discover this as possibly another kind of human, that more scientists would be involved with it and be willing to provide what you need?
Well, you know, looking back on it, that might have been a better way to go, but understand that 11 years ago, there was no Hobbit, there was no new thing from Siberia, so there was, to say that it was another kind of human was absolutely equal to saying it might be an alien. See what I mean? Either one was totally rejected. I couldn't get any real cooperation from anybody openly, publicly. Well, that's not to say, it's not fair, not to say nobody. There were a few people that let me use their names and still do. So, but the vast majority were just not open to the idea at all that they would be comfortable with having their fundamental paradigm about human existence upended. That's how they saw it as a real challenge and a real threat, and they just wanted me to go away and disappear and never darken their door again.
Don't feel bad, Lloyd. Nobody cooperates with us, and they all just want us to go away too. So.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, well, you know, if you have to look at anyone who's in a position of power and their income is dependent on that position of power, they're going to fight tooth and nail to keep anyone from rattling the cage. They just don't want to deal with it. And so that is exactly what they do. And I think if you or I were in their position, we'd probably do the same thing.
Probably. Now, Lloyd, do you think what really amazed me with the bones the similarity between the human bone and the Star Child. The look, the texture of it. Do you think aliens have the same bone structure as different, of course, but the same bone?
Yeah, when you say the same, they're really not the same at all. If you look at the Star Child bone compared to human bone, and you look at some of the pictures, we'll look at the picture should be in there where they're cut open and you can see the edges and you can see the difference in the thickness.
That's I did see those, yeah.
Density. Okay, so that's a difference. Then the biochemistry, the actual chemistry of the bone, completely different. You know, bone, human is bone. The Star Child bone is more like tooth enamel all over, very, very hard.
Right.
If you look at the surface, you look at the close-up pictures, the microscopic pictures of the surface of the bones, human bones are sprinkled with these little dents, these lacunae, that are all over, regularly sprinkled all over these dents. Star Child doesn't have that. It's just smooth. Those are gone. So it's like, and those things, by the way, are really important. You know, the lacuna, the little dents.
Right.
You know how they say that we change all of our cells every 7 years? We change our bodies. I don't know if you're aware of that, but every seven uh-huh. years, everything except our nerves and our brains change out, and our bones reconstitute. It's really amazing. We're like different, very different every 7 years. That's, you know, part of why the 7-year itch, they say, you know, where people undergo major changes every 7 years. So part of that is done in the bones, where those lacunae are some are sucking the old bone down in to be destroyed and recycled, whereas others of those dents are pushing the new bone up. So it's a very complex network and very important to the life of the individual, you know, that has them. Star Child doesn't have them. So what does it do? I mean, how does it cycle?
I guess I always thought with aliens, they would have some kind of indestructible bone structure. You know what I mean? Something that is like metal, or you know what I mean?
It's
sci-fi.
It's very, you know, it isn't metal, but it's very doggone close. I mean, it's really, really hard. When you see the effort it takes to cut the Star Child bone, as thin as it is, versus the effort that it takes to cut human bone, as thick as it is, it's really remarkable. I mean, you have to really struggle to get a Dremel blade down into Star Child bone and cut through it, as opposed to human bone. So there is it is much more durable, no question about it, and very, very different. And the fact that it is made up of a biochemistry that's the equivalent of tooth enamel, the fact that it has these very durable fibers woven through the matrix of the bone, and then the red residue on top of it, there are three things there that set the Star Child bone. And also lacking the lacunae, so that's four things that set it completely apart from human bone. So it's very, very, very unusual stuff, just in its physiology, notwithstanding the DNA. And the DNA is what's going to bring everything else to the fore about it.
Lloyd, right before we wrap, I got one more question. I just want to know what your thoughts are. Do you believe there's little Star Children out there still on our planet, in the woods, or high mountain tops?
I really don't think there are. I think that what that program, whatever it is that creates these things, I think is very carefully watched after, and how this one got through the cracks, slipped through the cracks 900 years ago is anybody's guess. But clearly there was some drama involved there, because the Star Child died, the human that was found with it carried its body way out in the middle of nowhere into this mine tunnel, buried it in a shallow grave, and then she laid down beside it, wrapped one of its hands around her arm, and killed herself. So she was running from whoever she, you know, was supposed to. There was some real drama there, whatever was going on, but I think her bringing it into the mine tunnel and burying it there is what kept them from being able to find it when they came to look for it, assuming that they did.
Now, one of my questions before we wrapped was going to be, why do you think there's so few Star Child references in skulls and bones in general? But it almost seems as though this might have been one out of many projects, and so you wouldn't see a lot of them.
I think this was a one in a many, 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 you know, million or whatever. And I'm not saying there are not other ones out there buried somewhere else from different circumstances, but the odds on one being buried in a mine tunnel so that it's extremely well preserved over a long period of time, and then to have somebody find one, I just think it's, you know, coincidence stacked on coincidence stacked on coincidence up to the point where it's like a billion to one shot, and it happened, and here we are, and we're dealing with it, and it's very exciting, and, you know, I think, I really do believe it's history in the making. I really do.
Well, very Lloyd, exciting stuff.
Sean, if you got, I know Sean probably has a million more questions, but do you have anything you need to ask Sean before we wrap tonight?
No, just special thanks to Lloyd. Lloyd, thanks for coming on the show.
Lloyd.
Well, thank you for having me, guys, and I hope that your audience understands what we've been talking about and can appreciate it.
I think you explained it very well because you dumbed it down to the point where I could understand, Lloyd. So
okay.
That's good because
if we cleared that hurdle, we got it, man.
I was lost there at the beginning, so we're good now. We're good. But, folks, starchildproject.com, www.starchildproject.com. And you can check out Lloyd's ebook. It's available ebook. You can download it. You can find it right on the website. I went to download it today. I haven't gotten to fully read it yet, but ebook available. And you know, we're not bringing you something here, folks, that hasn't been seen elsewhere. It, you know, National Geographic, BBC, Discovery, TLC, CBS, History Channel, Animal Planet, Fox. You name it, he's out there. And, you know, fascinating, fascinating stuff. www.starchild.com or starchildproject.com, sorry. And check it out. And Lloyd, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
And
we'll
Sean.
We'll do it again sometime.
Oh, we definitely will. You've been a lot of fun. Thank you so much. And Sean.
Right. Be sure to check out our website, guys, at www.ghostanddemon.com and log into our forums because we really want to hear from you.
And, let me turn the paper over here. It was upside down. And thanks, everybody, for joining us tonight for the Ghostman and Demon Hunter show. Join us next week where it won't be Easter. Thank goodness.
Yeah, it won't be Easter again.
Well, you never know. If it's a paranormal show, you never know what's going to happen. But
That's true.
Join us next week when it will be April 11th. 2010. We'll be back on the air.
Wow.
Thank you, Magnus Apollo, for joining us here tonight.
Well, thanks. I had a lot of fun.
And guys, you know, Sean, I got so used to Sean not being here. I was about to say his line, but you go ahead. You say it, Sean. You say it.
All right, guys, that's going to wrap up another Ghostman and Demon Hunter show. And don't you go changing, guys. You know we won't. We love you.
Good night, everybody.
Have a great week, guys. Go Butler!
So say goodnight to the bad guy.
Well, I don't like work where I work. I'm wasting my precious time. I'm working day in, slaving day out, and I'm losing my worried mind. I'm running my poor ass ragged, and I'm living from day to day. The boss man telling me what to do just makes me want to say to those heathens and hooligans, you won't get the hell out of here. Bother someone else for a while now, brother, I can use a beer. I don't need you and I don't need this, I want to make this perfectly clear. Listen up, heathens and hooligans, you want to get the hell out of here.
Yeah.